Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California officials are preparing for a deadly consequence of drought and triple-digit temperatures blanketing the state, that virtually all young salmon in the Sacramento River will die due to extreme heat. California Department of Fish and Wildlife declined an invitation to come on Insight this morning, but in an emailed statement, the state explains that because of shallow river levels, the water conditions are too hot for winter-run juvenile Chinook salmon to develop from eggs, preparing for the possibility of a near-complete loss. California is home to the most diverse species of salmon in the continental United States, with more than two dozen species of salmon, as well as steelhead and trout. This endangered species has battled a historically dwindling population, long threatened due to extinction, due to drought, not to mention dams and water infrastructure, reshaping the landscape of traditional fish runs. In response, there's been a collaborative effort to restore a healthy habitat that includes state, environmentalists, farmers, and indigenous tribes working to improve fish populations. So, with all of that in mind, we're going to explore the current dire situation and what solutions are taking place. Our first guest is Jeffrey Mount, a senior fellow with the Public Policy Institute of California's Water Policy Center, who specializes in the study of rivers, streams, and wetlands. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Vicky.
Why are salmon in such a dire condition during this drought?
Well, in particular, this drought is bad compared to previous droughts, and it's hot. I mean, this is an inescapable fact that about 20 years ago, we really switched into a much warmer climate. And that additional temperature, the warmth of these droughts, is putting tremendous stress. You've got to remember, salmon are very sensitive to temperature. I mean, and depending on which run of salmon you're talking about, they're all sensitive. Some are more sensitive than others. So that combination, low flow, high temperatures, is debilitating to all life stages of salmon, with the possible exception when they're in the ocean.
You know, I understand that what you're saying, that the drought is unique this time around, but it's not unique to California. What could have been done differently to be more protective of salmon and steelhead?
So I want to remind your listeners that the native species of fish, there's 130 native species of fish here in California, and roughly 80, more than 80 of them are actually endemic to, well, actually it's more closer to 100 of them are endemic to California. They are all adapted to drought. They have a series of traits, life history strategies for coping with drought, whether coping with the intensity of drought or recovering when the wets come again. And to put it bluntly, everything we do in water management, the way we manage our, the way we use reservoirs, the way we move water around, the way we reclaim land, everything works against those adaptations. So it really is no surprise that we've seen a long-term decline in all these fishes, not just salmon, because everything we do works against their strategy for coping with drought. And so what the problem is the way we manage water makes this drought contest even worse. I mean, there's very specific things we do during drought that cause that. But that's really where we are, as a sort of long-term cause of the decline in these species.
Yeah, when you bring up how salmon and the other native fish populations in the state are adapted to drought, can you also just discuss the arduous journey that salmon go through throughout their lifetime?
And that arduous journey is part of their adaptation. When you think about it, so the salmon that are coming into the system now will move up and lay their eggs in this system, and they already have. Many of the winter run Chinook salmon already have. Those eggs will mature over the space of a month or two, and they'll emerge as juveniles. And then as juveniles, they'll start their migration back to the ocean and eventually making their way back to the ocean. And some of those salmon will stay a year and a half in the ocean. Some of them will stay as much as 4 years in the ocean, again, depending on which race of salmon you're talking about. And then they'll make their way back into the waters of California and go through the spawning process again. It's rather heroic that's why salmon are so iconic. They're not just tasty, they're iconic. They're really an important part of our system. So salmon, because they sample the entire system from the headwaters all the way to the ocean, they're our bellwether. They're our indicator of the conditions that we have. And so they are doing poorly. And that's because they sample everything we do along the way. But the key adaptation of salmon, one of the key adaptations of salmon, they have a portion of their population, it's in the ocean all the time. And so when things are bad on land, they have a portion in the ocean. And that's bet hedging. That's the best way to describe it. They're hedging their bets when they do that. But right now we have poor ocean conditions. Well, yes, we've had a history of poor ocean conditions, and we have really rotten conditions on land. So it is very hard for these populations to recover. And that's the key with salmon. Again, I want to emphasize, this is the indicator fish of the condition of our ecosystems because they sample them all the way from the headwaters to the ocean.
There has been a concerted effort over the last years or even decades to restore fish populations, including salmon species. So who besides the weather is to blame for the current dire situation of at least the winter run juvenile Chinook salmon in the Sacramento River?
So we're all to blame. Can I just make it perfectly clear that all Californians are, because we all manage the, we all have responsibility for managing these ecosystems and managing the health of these ecosystems. So that's the first thing I want to say. But the second thing I want to say, which is keep in mind, and this is something that's really coming up a lot these days as this drought comes along, we have an antiquated approach to management that you just can't ignore. We have a 100-year-old water rights system, which doesn't do a good job of balancing what we call public trust values in water versus the sort of consumptive use. We have a system that was designed and put in place more than 70 years ago. The vast majority of our dams and reservoirs are more than 50 years old. So it's an antiquated system designed for the past. And then finally, our environmental laws are 50 years old, and we're still operating these environmental laws in the same way they were conceived back in the early 70s and late 60s. So what we have is a system which is not capable of adapting to what we're seeing, which is this real-time change. This last 22 years, warmer than ever in recorded history. The frequency of dry years has gone from 2 out of every 3 years to 3 out of every 4 years, and drought intensity has increased. So we've got this kind of rigid old system, which was a 20th century system with 21st century conditions. So that, I think, lies at the roots of the problem. And I will tell you, we're forced to try and make very tough decisions between the environment and regular use. I mean, farms and cities and how we use these. And that tension between the two is in part driving the decline in these fishes.
Is there anything we can do now, or is all lost for the year when it comes to the winter run Chinook that we're talking about?
Boy, that is a really good question. And I can tell you that in the regulatory agencies and the water operator agencies, they ask that question every morning when they wake up. But we have made decisions earlier this year, and decisions that were made in good faith, but were erroneous. And that is, we didn't reserve enough water behind our reservoirs to manage water temperatures below our reservoirs this year. And it's a different issue in the Klamath Basin, and we'll hear about that later. But this is what happened. I mean, we made decisions, and things didn't pan out. And so we're at a point where we're pretty much going to wipe out the entire, I mean, and it's not just the winter run Chinook salmon, but it's going to be spring run Chinook salmon, and it's probably going to be fall run Chinook salmon when they come back in. So we're likely to lose almost all the salmon this year, which is pretty bad, because, I mean, we did this back in 2014 and we did it in 2015. So in the space of 7 years, we've done this 3 times. So that's not working. And I think that's a good reason to take a hard look at the way we manage this system.
You know, the state, in their emailed statement, they said it to be proactive in an attempt to mitigate these challenges. They've actually trucked millions of hatchery-raised juvenile Central Valley fall run Chinook salmon this spring to the San Pablo Bay, San Francisco Bay seaside net pens due to projected poor river conditions, which we're currently experiencing in the Central Valley. Is that a silver lining? Does that make you optimistic for future populations?
No, and I want to be perfectly clear on that. Those are hatchery fish, and they're hatchery fish which are primarily intended to help maintain a commercial fishery and hopefully to feed orca that live off of San Francisco. That is not wild. Those are not wild fish. They're hatchery fish. And it is a Hail Mary attempt to try and keep some salmon going in this system in a year in which we'll wipe everything out. There's real problems. And boy, this is another insight. We could discuss hatchery reform. But hatcheries, the scientific community keeps pointing their fingers at the way we manage hatcheries is actually making it worse for wild salmon rather than better. And what we're making is flabby hatchery fish, which are not well adapted to this system, but it helps support a key commercial fishery and recreational fishery. But those are Hail Marys, but they're not going to solve this problem.
And finally, what happens if it's dry next year?
That is the other thing. Well, okay, so they wake up every morning worrying about how they're going to deal with this year, and then they go to bed every night thinking, oh my God, what happens if we have a year like this next year? So this is as dry as it was in 76 and 77, which is kind of the benchmark dry year. But the difference is it's warm. It's really, really warm. So this hot combination of hot and dry is really bad. We are currently drawing down our reservoirs at a rate which is quite large, and we can discuss why that is, but we're drawing down our reservoirs, so there's going to be very little water to carry over to next winter. So we're sort of dreading what will happen next winter and have to give some serious thought as to how we'll manage the reservoirs over the course of the winter and where we will set priorities for what flows into the reservoirs.
Jeffrey Mound is a senior fellow with PPIC's Water Policy Center, who specializes in the study of rivers, streams, and wetlands. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're learning more about the drought and extreme heat jeopardizing virtually all juvenile Chinook salmon in the Sacramento River. Now, the Sacramento River spans nearly 400 miles, rising from the Klamath Mountains in Siskiyou County near the Oregon border, traveling south through the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta towards the San Francisco Bay. Our next guest is senior biologist Mike Belchick with the Yurok Tribe in Siskiyou County. With over 30 years of experience concerning Klamath Basin water issues, discussing efforts to conserve and restore fish populations. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're a Western scientist working for an indigenous tribe. What is your role in navigating water issues, which proved to be complicated?
Oh, that's a really good question. So I work for the Yurok Tribe, which is located at the mouth of the Klamath River. And my job is to help restore the Klamath River. The Yurok Tribe have cultural values, which involve stewardship and the right to fish for salmon. And I was brought on about 25 years ago. And my job, quite simply, is to restore the Klamath River and the Trinity River, which is its major tributary, and ensure the future security of the salmon. And this year is putting that to the test, that's for sure.
You know, up in the Klamath Basin, Siskiyou County, what are the conditions of the river like this year?
Well, as we heard on the Sacramento, where they're losing almost all the fish, that is also occurring on the Klamath. But the cause is a little bit different. Instead of just brute force heat mortality like they're experiencing on the Klamath or on the Sacramento, we have a runaway disease problem that's caused in part by low flows and warm temperatures, but also caused by bed immobility due to the dams, basically an ecological imbalance. So what happened this year was the fish all caught a disease called C. Shasta, and the disease infectivity rate, which is how many of the fish were infected, and the mortality rate went through the roof, and essentially on the upper Klamath, we lost almost our entire year class of salmon due to that.
And when you're talking about habitat issues, and you talked about this disease, is that the fish pathogen that known as ick in the Klamath River?
No, that's a different disease. Ick is a different disease which caused the adult fish kill in 2002. We had some reappearance of that in 2014 and 2015. But we haven't had a massive fish kill. It's something we are ever vigilant on. And we actually have secured some water releases from the Trinity to help with that. Although, much like the Sacramento, the Trinity Reservoir, large lake, which on the headwaters of the Trinity River, is perilously low and also running out of cold water pool, just like the reservoirs on the Sacramento River are.
California Department of Fish and Wildlife says that four Klamath River dams slated for removal by 2024, which is the largest dam removal undertaking in U.S. history. You're actively involved and interested in this process. Explain why it's crucial.
Well, first of all, 2023, we have not given up on holding this on timeline. We still believe we can hold it on time. There's so many reasons why dam removal is important. First of all, in terms of security against climate change, like we're experiencing right now, there are areas of cold water above those dams, including large springs in the bed of the river, other rivers in the upper Klamath Basin, like the Williamson and the Wood River, which have stable supplies of cold water. Right now, that cold water is lost. It is caught, swept up into the reservoirs and warmed up, and the fish have no access to that. We believe getting fish access to these areas is a long-term way to secure the future of these fish. In addition, the dams cause really poor water quality. They raise the water temperature during a fall migration, almost 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Obviously, as you know, Dr. Mount talked about earlier, this is not good for fish. And then finally, they interrupt the sediment supply, which has caused an what we call an armored bed or immobile riverbed, which has tilted the ecology in such a way to make the disease which wiped out our fish this year, run out of control and kill all of our fish this year. So this disease is something that's always been there, but it's balanced like this. And all the scientific information, as well as the traditional environmental knowledge about balance, points to the fact that the dam removal will help immensely to alleviate this disease condition, which is wiping out all of our fish.
When talking about salmon and the role that they play in the ecosystem in the Sacramento River and in rivers across the state, if they're wiped out this year, what role do they play in the imbalance of the ecosystem in California?
Well, I think one of the, you know, primary values that the tribe has is that, you know, people are part of the ecosystem, that the fish exist along with the people, and that people are given a stewardship mission to take care of the fish. They're co-equals. They're one and the same in this. And so the Yurok people, traditional environmental knowledge, always knew about the keystone role that the fish played in on the whole system. And I think Western science in the last couple of decades is catching up. They're doing, you know, radioisotope studies and watching how the fish power the entire ecosystem and figuring out all the animals that eat these. But the Yurok tribe and the elders, they always knew. And so what we're trying to do here in securing the future is to keep hold of that balance, to make sure that it goes forward for future generations.
You know, I chatted about this with Jeffrey, but I'm going to bring up the hatchery solutions that the state was bringing up. In addition to the Central Valley, the state said that they relocated over 1 million Chinook salmon from the Iron Gate Hatchery in Siskiyou County. And they said it was the first time that the state has not released salmon into the Klamath River since construction of the hatchery in 1962. I guess, what goes through your mind when you hear that? Is there any optimism in that?
Well, you know, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife was faced with an impossible task this year. At the time when we would normally release all the hatchery fish into the river, the Sea Shasta disease was raging out of control. And last year, almost every hatchery fish just simply died. We put them in the river, they catch a disease and they die. So there were various options discussed, including trucking the fish down to the lower river. We were strongly opposed to that because then the fish, when they come back as adults, just simply put, scientifically, they're lost. They don't know where they're from. So they go ahead and stray and mix in with the other fish. We still have genetic integrity on the Klamath River. All the runs that return to the various tributaries are genetically unique. And unlike the Sacramento, which has just become a mishmash of genetics, we still do have good genetics on the Klamath. So we urge the department to preserve those genetics, to not truck the fish. And the solution they came up with was to move them temporarily to Trinity Hatchery. And they're going to move them back to the Klamath and release them in the fall. We thought this was the best, the least bad option of a lot of different bad options that they had. So we supported that.
Finally, anything in the future that you're looking at that makes you optimistic with this dire situation facing salmon populations and overall fish populations throughout the state?
Well, I think, you know, something that we're looking forward to is dam removal. We think that it won't magically restore the climate. There's a lot more work to do, but it's a linchpin element. It is the largest fish restoration project that's ever been attempted. And that's what it is. It's a fish restoration project. So we think that dam removal will help. It'll help with the temperature regime, with the excess nutrients that are present in the river, the disease conditions. There's still a lot more to go. In particular, we have big problems on two of the major tributaries to the Klamath, which are the Shasta and Scott. Right now, the rivers, those rivers are either dry or nearly drying out, and something has to be done to help those fish. We simply cannot allow major salmon rivers like the Shasta and Scott to go dry as they have been. And so we're looking forward to some actions taking place on those rivers too.
Mike Belchuk is a senior biologist with the Yurok Tribe in Siskiyou County discussing efforts to conserve and restore fish populations in the Klamath Basin. Mike, a pleasure having you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Up next, net neutrality under the Biden administration, the president's call to restore it, and how California factors in. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Net neutrality. It ensures a level playing field for internet service providers and their customers. That means you. Without net neutrality rules in place, internet providers are free to control access to the internet and can charge more and slow or block websites and apps. In 2018, the Federal Communications Commission, commonly known as the FCC, voted to end the Obama administration-era regulations. But earlier this month, President Joe Biden signed off on an executive order urging the FCC to restore net neutrality rules, to promote broadband competition, and ensure broadband companies are transparent with their pricing. In California, providers don't have to follow net neutrality rules because of state laws enacted back in 2018, laws that the state was only able to start enforcing this past February after years of opposition from both the Trump administration and the telecom industry. Maggie Reardon is a senior reporter for CNET News. She recently wrote about the president's call to restore net neutrality regulations. Maggie joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
All right. I think this is all important to have a little refresher because we all hear about net neutrality. But just for some context, we know net neutrality maintains a level playing field. But what exactly is it?
So net neutrality is the principle that all traffic on the internet should be treated equally. So regardless of whether you're checking Facebook or you're posting pictures to Instagram or you're streaming movies from Netflix or Amazon, it means that a company like AT&T or Comcast, which also owns NBC Universal, that they can't favor their own content or service over a competitor's.
Why should people and businesses care about net neutrality?
Well, really, it's about who is going to police the internet and who is going to be able to hold or whether anyone in the federal government can hold big telcos accountable for, not charging, overcharging people or blocking people's access or, again, favoring their own content. So, you know, right now we're in a huge discussion in Washington about a big social media companies. Well, this is a way to sort of rein in some of these big telcos who really control the superhighway and also a lot of the content that you get.
I think to understand the situation that we're currently in, let's go back a few years. What exactly did the 2015 net neutrality rules actually do?
So those rules actually were really the main point of them was to make sure that big providers, internet providers, could not block or slow down traffic to the internet. So it would ensure that you could get access to the internet. Another big aspect of those rules was that companies like a Comcast or an AT&T or Verizon would not be able to charge a company like Netflix additional fees to get their movies stream to customers faster. And that's really important because someone like Netflix could probably afford to pay for that premium service so that their service is better than a competitor's. But it really would mean that any kind of startup that's coming on the scene would have a hard time competing. So that was outlawed as part of the 2015 rules.
Are there any net neutrality rules in place right now at the federal level?
There aren't. Those were repealed after President Trump was elected. He appointed Ajit Pai, who was a Republican, to be chair of the FCC. And in 2017, they repealed the rules. And so since then, on a national level, there have not been any rules protecting the internet and access to the internet. And one other thing that the 2015 rules did that was really important, and I sort of omitted there. There was another aspect that's very wonky and technical, but the FCC reclassified broadband as what's called a Title II service. And why that's important is it really, that was sort of the cornerstone that gave the FCC its authority to implement all these other rules. So when that was taken away in 2017, the FCC basically lost its authority to really police any of the big providers on broadband.
Following net neutrality rules being rolled back under the Trump administration, what has been the impact since then?
Well, there are, the telcos would say that they've been investing more in broadband and internet. But some of the skeptics and some of the folks who want net neutrality in place say that, you know, there could be a tendency for these big providers to, again, favor their own content and start pushing out competitors or not allowing competitors to compete with them, particularly when it comes to like online streaming type services. So, you know, it's hard to say. There's really, I haven't seen huge changes since the rules were repealed, but I think that, again, it goes to the heart of this argument is really about whether the federal government is going to have a role in making sure these really big companies are playing fair. And for example, as we talk about pricing, as you said in your intro, that could play into a role for the FCC. But right now, because there's no new net neutrality and because they repealed that Title II designation, there's really no authority for the FCC to step in and require broadband companies to either provide more information to them or to at all limit how much they can charge customers or do anything to address pricing on that level.
Right, because businesses and also individuals, I mean, we depend on broadband to reach customers, especially if you're a business. So is there any prevention of unfair methods of competition?
Well, I think with the FCC's role, what they're trying to do without net neutrality is, you know, there are some things that they can do to try to promote competition. You know, that goes into a lot of policy aspects and how they direct money. But in terms of enforcement, you know, they don't have the authority to regulate broadband. And when we think of things as being a utility, many of our utilities are regulated services, and that's regulated by the government. Right now, the government has no ability to do that for broadband, which I think everybody, you know, since the pandemic believes is an essential service.
Right. California and Washington, they have their own laws when it comes to net neutrality rules. Can you explain the law here in California?
Yeah, so California, some are saying, I mean, that could be sort of the benchmark of any new laws or any new regulations that come out from the FCC, because California went even further than the 2015 rules. So they had all that in place with the no blocking, no slowing down, no favoring content. But then they added some other aspects. For example, they banned the practice of what's called zero rating. And that is where a company like AT&T, for example, might offer its wireless customers who have data caps, they might offer their video service at no charge to the data cap, right? You can just stream AT&T video all you want. And that sounds great, except that that's really favoring AT&T's video service. And if you wanted to use a different video service, like, you know, YouTube, or you wanted to use Netflix, if they didn't have some special deal to get that net neutrality, or to get that sort of free access with no hit to your data cap, then you know, a customer is going to pick the other service. So it really is harmful to competition. So that was a big area that California went sort of in a different path and went for a stricter rule on net neutrality.
Yeah. Why are there only two states that enacted their own laws for net neutrality? Why aren't other states also enacting, you know, their own net neutrality rules?
Well, there are states, you know, who have tried, and it has, you know, not passed the legislature. You know, and it's a really good question, because what we found is that a large, vast majority of the population really actually supports these general protections. You know, going state by state isn't sort of the most ideal way to approach this. You know, I think that everybody would probably prefer to have the federal government play a role in this so that it's consistent across the country. But it's funny, because California is such a big state and is so important to the economy and has so many users, that in general, a lot of times when regulations are adopted there, it almost becomes the de facto standard for the country, because, you know, providers are going to be hesitant to, you know, use different rules, say, for someone in Pennsylvania than they would in California, because it just makes it more difficult for them, you know, to manage their business. So in some ways, it almost becomes the de facto. And also, California is often a leader in pushing for stricter types of regulation that the federal government then ends up adopting. And I think some people are thinking that might happen in this case as well.
With President Biden's executive order earlier this month concerning net neutrality, is that effectively just going back to the Obama-era policies that the Trump administration rolled back on?
Well, it's really unclear at this point. So, I mean, his executive order really has no teeth to it, in the sense that it doesn't put rules back in place. It's basically urging the FCC to start a proceeding, which is going to take a really long time because they, you know, government works slowly, to get rules back in place. And so as part of that process, they would have to introduce a proposal, and then they would have to take comment on it, and there would be a lot of debate. The problem, though, that we have right now is the FCC only has 4 members. It should have 5. It should have 3 Democrats, because we have a Democratic president and 2 Republicans. Right now, we just have 2 and 2, because President Biden has not named a new permanent FCC chair. So that will be really telling in terms of who he picks. I mean, he's clearly signaled that that would be his preference, that they have these net neutrality rules in place. But you have to remember, the FCC is an independent agency. It doesn't do what the president says. So he would have to appoint a chair who would be thinking along the same lines as he is. And in terms of net neutrality.
And that would need to go through a confirmation process, right?
It would have to go through a Senate confirmation process. And then once you get through that process, then they would have to work up some language and a proposal that they would have to put out for comment, public comment. So, I mean, we're talking like at least a year away before anything would like realistically happen in terms of new rules being put in place.
I mean, you mentioned that President Biden's executive order doesn't have any teeth to it, but already there's already an inclination that there's going to be a legal fight ahead, whatever the teeth are, you know, in the future. And internet service providers, they have deep pockets to fight in court, and they opposed the Obama administration policies. It was unpopular back during that time. So I guess what's in it for them?
Yeah, I mean, right now everybody's posturing, right? So I think everybody who's been covering this issue, and I've been covering it for almost 20 years, every time the federal government does anything to implement any type of net neutrality regulation or rule, the telcos are going to fight it, and they're going to fight it in court. So that's almost a given. Everybody expects that. What's kind of interesting is, you know, they've been to court twice before, at least twice before, 3 times maybe. And every time they lose something in that battle, and then the progressives come back and they want even stricter rules. So, you know, that could happen here. So we'll have to see. I mean, it's if the FCC were to implement new rules, it would definitely be another legal fight.
Finally, given that you have 20 years of reporting on net neutrality, what is the future of net neutrality in the U.S. then? I mean, what are you interested in the months ahead?
Well, I think, you know, everybody agrees the only way that we're going to sort of get a final say on this issue is if there's legislation. Like, we've seen this already over the past decade, especially. Like, this issue has just ping-ponged back and forth, you know, and it's become a very partisan issue, at least on Capitol Hill. Again, not amongst the public. Republicans and Democrats support the idea of net neutrality. So the problem is that, you know, if the FCC were to adopt something, this is a Democratic administration, then when a Republican comes into office, it'll just get repealed. So Congress needs to act, and whatever authority they, you know, the FCC is trying to give the FCC, whatever authority Congress would like the FCC to have, they need to really codify that in a statute and make it clear so that they're able to, which is what I think many net neutrality supporters want, which is they want the FCC to have the power and the authority to be able to regulate broadband.
Maggie Reardon is a senior reporter for CNET News. We appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thanks for having me.
Still ahead, we're joined by Cap Radio's modern music director, Nick Bruner, who has a slate of local NPR Tiny Desk entrants to introduce us to. You can join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Each year, unsigned artists from across the country vie for the Tiny Desk Spotlight and submit their original songs, including several musical acts from across Northern California. Each year, one artist or group wins the grand prize and gets to play their very own Tiny Desk concert. This year's Tiny Desk contest is closed for submissions, and now the selection process is ongoing. So with that, Cap Radio modern music director Nick Bruner and host of Hey Listen gets us up to speed on this year's Tiny Desk contest and checks in with local entrants of past years. Always a pleasure, Nick.
Hey, nice to be back, Vicky. Hi.
Well, let's just tap into where we are with this year's contest.
Yes. As you'd mentioned, the deadline for submissions is closed, and NPR's panel in Washington, D.C. is sifting through a big boatload of entrants across the country, and we should be finding out in the coming months who's going to win the national prize. In that time, just last week, I received Californians' entrants for the Tiny Desk contest, and I'm going to be sifting through those with a local group of writers, three from here at Cap Radio and one from the music community. And we're going to be showcasing our favorites like we do every year.
Can you give us a preview of how impressed you are with the local talent?
I can't give you anything that would be worth it yet. But in the coming weeks, you'll start to see those things trickle out online onto programs like Hey Listen, and I hope to bring entrants here to Insight as the weeks and months roll on.
We are looking forward to that. Well, take us back and let's revisit entrants of past years.
Sure. Let's start with Camilla Covington. She entered the Tiny Desk contest with the Shaun Thwaites Rebel Quartet back in 2019. And that entry just blew us away. We had to invite them in for an in-studio performance, and that, too, is just fantastic. It remains one of our most popular videos, let alone in-studio sessions, over at our YouTube channel. Last month, Camilla released a solo EP called Love Letters and Prophecies that was on the heels of a couple of singles in 2020. It was from that EP. This is a track called Jealous.
You've been sleeping. Two-stepping through the evening platonically, and bottom joke about running away and getting hella fat. And I swear, it feels like one day we'll follow suit. You've been sleeping over. I might blow my cover. Would you run from me if I became a
Her voice is so papery and playful, and I really just love that EP from start to finish. And it's been so much fun watching Camila's songwriting career since I learned about who she was a couple of years ago. And I hope I'm not blowing the lid off of anything too early, but I mentioned a local artist from the community writing about this year's Tiny Desk entrance. I asked Camila to do that, so...
That makes a lot of sense. I subscribe to her on YouTube, and I love the fact that she's still done some live performances, I mean, for video on YouTube, just throughout the year, through January. I even watched one just earlier this month. Who is next, Nick?
Spacewalker. She released a record last month, too. It's called Crystal Baller. So Spacewalker, a.k.a. April Walker, she is this funky, spacey songwriter. And to see her perform live, I've done this a couple of times, watching her build loops and beats and singing and rapping and playing music over them is just this hypnotic experience. I think her last Tiny Desk entry was something like 8.5 minutes long. On Crystal Baller, the closing track is her covering David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust. And this might be her at her most subdued.
Ziggy played for time, driving us that way. The kids were just cracks. He was the nice ones with God-given knives. Oh, he took it all too far. But boy, could he play guitar?
That's a lot of fun. How long has she been on the scene?
She's been on the scene for, I want to say, like at least the last 5 years. And it's just a good time watching her on stage. Crystal Baller is her fifth record she can find on Bandcamp. And I really love that she kind of brings this sort of kind of dub reggae inflection to that track. She's always been a big devotee of David Bowie's, but you can also hear acts like George Clinton in her work, too.
Who's next?
Trey Burt. This guy is a knockout. Trey entered the Tiny Desk contest in 2019, or at least that's when I found out more about his work and started really diving in. Since then, he's been signed. He's been signed to Oh Boy Records, a label that he shared with John Prine, among other artists. Trey's been invited to perform on Willie Nelson's Luck Reunion Tour, which he performed virtually back in March. He's blowing up in a big way, and he released this track back in September of 2020. It's called Under the Devil's Knee.
Louisville, Kentucky, the DA and the mayor, they have yet to charge the three thugs who killed Breonna Taylor. They broke into her home at midnight unannounced without badges or warrant. So Kenny stood his ground to protect the woman he loved. And they fired 20 rounds at the window through the curtains from outside. Gotta work the long shift, had dreams to be a nurse. How I wish I could have saved her, this American curse. Don't tell me your position, I don't need no sympathy. Yeah, your bleeding heart's complicit, you ain't in the street. Now's the time to use that privilege, wake up from the sleep, get out the way. We ain't waiting for next time. Under the devil's knee. Lord, I'm under the devil's knee. Oh, I'm screaming, can I breathe? My
And that is essentially a eulogy to George Floyd and Breonna Taylor.
Yes, matter of fact, you can find the full lyrics for that track over at Trey's Bandcamp page. Got the attention of Cornel West, also from Sacramento. His work is excellent, and he has a new album coming out on August the 27th called You, Yeah, You.
I mean, it's just so incredibly powerful.
You can hear some Dylan vibes in that tune, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's become part of the Trey Burt legend when he was living in Portland in 2014, him sneaking into a Bob Dylan show, which is pretty great. So I think Dylan would have approved.
All right, so going back to the Tiny Desk contest of this year, when do you think the winner's going to be announced?
I think we're going to hear it. So typically, it's just a couple months after the contest deadline closes. So I don't want to rest on my heels with too much of waiting around here. So I would like to get the CAP radio list out by the end of August so that by September, we can sit back and wait for the national contestant to be announced.
I would imagine it's, I know it's a hard job, but a fun job to go through all those submissions.
Oh, it's terrific fun. It's a coup to be able to do this. I can't believe I get to. I snuck in.
What's coming up with Hey Listen?
Hey Listen. Oh, well, we're going to have an interview and more music from Camilla Covington this coming weekend. Also look for that interview online at capradiomusic.org. And I have been kicking the can down the road on getting one of my favorite cake instrumentals on the show as well. So that's at this early moment, what I can tell you.
That's a nice eclectic feel. Yeah, when you're chatting with local artists across our area, you know, just given the current circumstances, things are reopening. How are they feeling more than a year into really halting live performances?
It really depends on who you talk to. I spoke with a musician called I Am Strikes, a.k.a. Kelly Rosenthal, a couple of months ago, and she is beyond excited to be able to perform again and just have like a gritty, visceral onstage experience. Other musicians I've spoken with have just, you know, they're playing it by ear. Like we all are, you know. Yeah. I think that it's your mileage may vary when it comes to your enthusiasm to be out in the middle of humanity.
Of course, yeah. There's definitely some adjustment after, you know, the last 16 months we've all been through. Mm-hmm. Any live performances, you know, coming up are you that you're looking forward to?
Oh, man, you put me on the spot. I did buy tickets to a San Francisco show that's coming up in November, a band I really love called Idols. They're from the UK. As for local showcases, they exist. There's a handful of performances that have already happened that I've really loved at the Red Museum. I know Harlow's is opening back up again, and outside of specific, Thundercat is coming to Sacramento as well. They're playing Ace of Spades.
I can't wait to listen to live music again. I've done a little bit myself, but a lot more hopefully in store this summer.
Well, I'll see you out there.
Nick Bruner with Cap Radio's Hey Listen and Cap Radio's Modern Music Director. Thank you for joining us, as always.
Thanks, Vicky.
All right. Well, that's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow, and we're leaving you with Trey Burt, Under the Devil's Knee. How I wish I could have saved this American curse. Don't tell me your position, I don't need no sympathy. Yeah, your bleeding heart's complicit, you ain't in the street. Now's the time to use that privilege, wake up from the sleep, get out the way, we ain't waiting for next time. Under the devil's knee, oh Lord, I'm under the devil's knee. Oh, I'm screaming, I cannot breathe.